Now we come to the lecture of the 24th of May 1921. Rudolf Steiner starts. He says that we've seen that the 4th century AD is a very important turning point in mankind's evolution. And one can say that a characteristic person of this 4th century AD is indeed Augustine. When we consider Augustine, we have in front of us a real representative of this 4th century AD. In the early part of his life, he points backwards to the ancient culture. And then you can designate with him a very sharp transition, which leads him towards an absolute subjection to the Roman Catholic Church. Augustine places on one side the realm of knowledge and focuses himself inwardly, subjectively, in a practical way with the concept of faith, insofar as he adopts the viewpoint. He's not quite sure what the actual fundamental basis of truth is, which he could recognize. And finally, he decides to accept the truth of the Catholic Church, which he acknowledges it, because the Catholic Church establishes itself, prescribes the concept of faith. Augustine arrived at this standpoint through very hard life battles. A certain time, he followed the teaching of Manichaeism. Remember, I pointed to previous lectures in which I told you that again and again there seems to emerge up to the surface the aspects that have appeared in the Indian, Persian, Chaldean, Egyptian periods. And these viewpoints coming from antiquity, they try to form a reaction against that which had begun to develop in the intellectual capacities of mankind. And the teaching of Manichaeism, or the Manichaeans, represent such a reaction proceeding from antiquity. But we have to point out that in those regions of his African homeland, the teachings of Manichaeans already had were beginning to be doubted. Augustine, in the first place, was completely taken over by the teachings of the Manichaeans. However, when he came in contact with a certain bishop of the Manichaeans, when he came in contact with a certain person named Faustus, the whole way in which this man presented the teaching of Manichaeans was completely rejected by Augustine. Now it is necessary for us to penetrate through the dialectic which confronted Augustine. One must more concentrate upon the essential nature of this Manichaean teaching. And this essential nature of this Manichaean teaching can be explained inwardly only when you realize that the true teachings of Manichaeism have not maintained themselves for the modern age. The only thing that has maintained itself was that which was cited by the Christian teachers of the first centuries, and which were then combated. What we know about Manichaeism is what the opponents tell us about it. Nevertheless, if we focus upon the way in which Augustine related himself to the teaching of the Manichaeans, then we will be able to perceive something about the nature of the Manichaean teaching itself. Augustine turned himself away from the teaching of the Manichaeans because he said the following: he's looked for the truth in the sun, in the stars, in the clouds, in the rivers, in the springs, in the mountains. He looked for truth in the realm of the plant world, in the realm of the animal world. In short, he looked for the truth in everything which confronted him in a visible way. But there he never found the truth. Because all that confronted him externally visible merely offered him only the external material aspect, and he was looking for the spiritual. Then Augustine turned away from the Manichaean teaching towards Neoplatonism. The Neoplatonist turned himself away from the sensual external world. He did not want to emphasize the external sense world, but wanted to unite himself in his own inward being with the, he wanted to unite himself with the All One in his own inner being, unite himself with the All One in a kind of mystical abstraction. Neoplatonism, Augustine lived himself into the non-objective, non-material, non-sensual, abstract world. In contrast to that, in contrast to this Neoplatonism, Manichaeism could offer him something which, as it were, was merely a registration, a registration of the external material things, which then were presented as of a divine nature. But the person who today comes to spiritual science, he will learn to be able to see these external material things in the correct way. I've already told you about this situation from the spiritual scientific point of view. If you develop yourself to imaginative, to inspirational knowledge, then you will gradually learn to know the inner organs of the human being. You'll gradually learn to know the inner organs in a concrete way. But you don't get that mystical, cloudy world of which so many false mystics dream. But what you get is, in an objective perception, seeing through of the inner organs of the human being. Precisely insofar as one grasps the inner organs of the human being as a result of the spiritual, insofar as in this way you can see through them in a spiritual way, there you learn actually to know them as of a material nature. These material organs are really a result of the spiritual. Let me give you an example. Let us say a more abstract thinking person learns to know the so-called hypochondriac. Now, this abstract thinking person very easily will say about this hypochondriac that there's nothing really physically wrong with him. He is merely psychologically wrong. Continuously transposes himself into his own inner being, and he lives himself, as it were, completely in a self-observation. Because of that, he judges the things of the external world in a false way. He judges the things of the external world often in such a way that he accuses them of persecuting him. In any case, or other things like that, but in any case, through that, he arrives at a false relationship to the external world. And because of that, the abstract thinking person can very easily come to the conclusion that there's nothing physically wrong with a hypochondriac, he is only psychologically wrong. He's only psychologically ill. Such an abstract conclusion is a result of the fact that one is not able to look into the actual inner construction, the inner configuration of the human organization. This inner configuration of the human organization is indeed so, that man is a three-membered being. There we have the head organization, which, to be sure, as I've often told you about it, this head organization actually stretches itself over the whole of the organism. However, the main part of it, its main center, is in the head, and hence it is designated as the head organization. There we have the rhythmical organization of the breast organs, which includes the breathing, the blood circulation. And then we have all that which goes on in the metabolism organism, and it stands in connection with the limbs attached to it. The situation is so that in the head organization, the single organs turn themselves to the external world, and because of that, they are external sense organs. But also in the other members of the human organization, we find that the organs, besides the fact that they may be organs of digestion, at the same time, they are in a certain connection sense organs. And we find a kind of correspondence, a kind of polarity between the head organs and the organs of the metabolism. The organs of the metabolism are also sense organs, only they are sense organs which are not directed towards the external, but they are sense organs which are directed towards the processes which are going on within the human skin. And so we find, for example, that the man in his head organization has the smell organ, the nose, directed towards the external. And with this nose, he smells that which exists externally in his environment. Now, corresponding to this smell organ, to this nose, there is in his metabolism organs corresponding to the smell organ, to the nose, there is the liver in the digestion organ. The liver actually smells that which is in its environment, which is the inner being of man. We're all that which has a relationship of the smell organ to the external world. Then you have the relationship of the liver to the inner human processes, the processes going on within the inner human being. Now, when you come to consider the hypochondriac, he is a hypochondriac because his liver is physically not in order. It's out of order physically, his liver. Because the ordinary liver problems are not bound up with any type of pain, so you don't notice it as a physically perceptible illness, but it manifests itself as a soul experience, as a psychological problem, if the liver is not properly in order. If the liver, in a false way, smells inwardly, the hypochondriac is nothing other than that person whose liver is not in order. Liver of the hypochondriac may become too sensitive in this way, and when it smells, it doesn't find it too sympathetic. With this ill liver, he is continuously smelling his own inner being, and it is this inner smelling of his own inner being which is at the basis of his hypochondriac soul situation. This is an example of how imaginative and inspired knowledge can explain the so-called psychological illnesses out of their actual physical basis. In many cases, there's a physical basis for psychological illnesses, for mental illnesses, just as many physical illnesses have to be understood from a spiritual standpoint. All this you can see that the seer, the spiritual scientist, is able to come to a recognition of how the spiritual works in the material. And he doesn't consider the liver merely in the way in which the person, the anatomist, sees the liver, observes the liver only in the dissecting room. However, the spiritual scientist is able to see the liver as an organ which is in its external form, is entirely different from the center, from the nose. But nevertheless, the liver represents a metamorphosis of this nose smell organ. This you can see that the spiritual scientist tries to understand the material aspect through its revelations and doesn't fall into the trap of all sorts of mystical schwärmerei, nebulous sinking down in your own inner being. All of this nebulous sinking down in your own inner being to find the truth just like that is the result of a certain non-inclination to deal with real knowledge, and therefore you're going to brood inside your inner being, realizing that what comes to meet you from that is the result of the constitution of your own inner physical organisms. In fact, from this point of view, a person who follows the so-called path of inner mysticism, you can consider him to be subject to a kind of spiritual illness, which means a physical illness. In other words, you can consider the so-called mystic to be suffering from a physical illness. It manifests itself as a mental illness, insofar as he broods inside of himself. I've described all this to you, my dear friends, in order to make you understand that it is this shaon, this looking of the spiritual into the material, which confronted Augustine in Manichaeism. But you must remember, because he had a Greek mother, Monica, because of that, he was born into the yearning of trying to come out, extract himself from the physical. Because of that, he turned himself to Neoplatonism. And on the bypath of Neoplatonism, he was able to turn himself to Roman Catholicism. So we can see how in this 4th century AD, in which the education, the development of Augustine falls, in that 4th century AD, men turn themselves away from the spiritual observation of the external world, and also from the spiritual observation of the inner world. This turning away had to occur, because if it did not occur, man would never have become a free person. He would always have felt himself just to be a member of the external world. Man, as it were, had to extricate himself from this involvement in the external world. He had to turn away from the external world. Though I might say, that point where man lost the consciousness that he is a member of the external world, just as the finger is a member of your own body, this high point lies in the 4th century AD. That which provided the Geprege, the imprint of this 4th century AD, was a development of mankind, which, taken in the main, came right out of the human organism. I might say, out of the blood. In the southern European districts, in the northern African districts, in the Near East districts, human beings had arrived at the fact, being forsaken by their actual own human nature, insofar as this human nature is a physical and etheric one, and to rise up to something of an indefinite nature. Of course, in order to arrive into the intellectuality, man had to develop himself towards something of an indefinite nature. One might say, to an emptiness, where you are no longer dependent upon the blood. A place where man no longer developed his life viewpoint out of his racial nature. To such an empty situation, the man had to develop himself in order to arrive into the intellectuality. Before this 4th century AD, the single tribes, the single nations, as far as their life viewpoints, as far as their knowledge was concerned, all that had arisen out of their own blood. That's how they developed themselves. Just as we today still develop ourselves towards a change of teeth, which certainly we do not develop out of our intelligence, but we develop out of our organic substances. As today, out of our own organism, we arrive at a power of judgment insofar as we have to arrive at our time of puberty. All this arising out of your own blood. In a similar way, these tribes developed their ancient instinctive imaginations and inspirations out of their own blood, and that had all over a racial origin. And when anywhere two races, two nations mixed themselves together, then they had a differentiated blood. A nation remained below, they became enslaved. The other folk formed the upper classes, the upper 10,000. So indeed, these social differentiations, just as that which lived in the knowledge aspect, in the souls of the human being, all that was absolutely a result of the race nature, of the blood. These, in the 4th century AD, these southern peoples who were living around the Mediterranean, they began to develop themselves out of the blood. Now they began to work themselves upwards to a pure spiritual aspect, because intelligence, the intellect, is developed out of the sphere of the pure spiritual. The people out of these Mediterranean peoples, Mediterranean nations, after the 4th century AD, they were pointed to the situation of, as it were, of no longer having a basis, a grundlage, a foundation. The blood gave them nothing more, nothing anymore. Out of the racial basis, they no longer were able to develop soul faculties. Those soul faculties, which once upon a time came out of their racial blood, no longer came from there. And so people in these districts developed themselves into out of an empty space, you might say. There was a kind of vacuum. And so the people of the Mediterranean regions, they had to have something else upon which they could lean. That which earlier on was given to them out of the blood, now they must able to receive it from the external. This vacuum was filled in by those calculating people who had knowledge out of the ancient wisdom teachings. They knew how things actually were situated. So they carried over the ancient state viewpoint of the Roman Empire. They transferred that into the religious aspect. And so the external Catholic Church was established. This external Catholic Church, it was able to conserve that element which in earlier times came up out of the different races in their spiritual life. They conserved that which could be preserved from ancient times, and they condensed all that into dogmas. These dogmas were continually propagated, were planted forward, no longer out of the human being. But that which was there became condensed into dogmas. And with that, there was a non-living element, and received a non-living element from the external to replace that more living element which earlier on he had received from his interior being. The Latin language as a dead language was fortgepflanzt, propagated, was promoted, and the life of knowledge took its course in the Latin language. So you have the one spiritual stream which consisted in the fact that, as it were, that which was the ancient life viewpoint was brought into a dead element. Now, if nothing else had entered into the situation, this dead element would gradually have to die away, and then the whole so-called culture would have had to die off. Indeed, had something of a high nature, because it was something high which at that time had lived itself up. The Catholic Church itself had taken over much Gnostic Manichaean elements, but she had eliminated the terminology. She promoted the old world conceptions. She took up the old cult forms. She preserved them and preserved the old world conceptions. She preserved the old cults and preserved them and propagated them in a dead language. That which the Catholic Church propagated and continued to promote was just as barren as a woman who is incapable of giving birth to a child. But this was only one side of the situation which was now necessary in order to go forward. The other side of the being of the situation consisted in the fresh blood, came from the Germanic and other tribes who migrated over from the north and east of Europe. And the remarkable thing was that these tribes, in their development, had remained behind when you compare them to the southern peoples. When we use the word remaining behind in their evolution or development, please don't take this word in a judgmental way. These southern peoples had advanced to the highest development, out of which the intellect emerged itself. The intellect which stood in its highest stage of development in the 4th century AD. So we have the developing, the further living of this dead intellect, and confronting it, you have the Germanic blood of the other peoples who there emerged. We can say that within a certain period of time there occurred a complete change, a complete transformation, a metamorphosis of the Western life. In a wide domain of Europe, the so-called folk migration, tribe migration, you see the old culture dies away and a kind of peasant culture begins to rise up, which the upper 10,000 possessed as their culture in the ancient Roman Empire, that dies away. What remains was that which was possessed by the broad population consisting of the Germanic tribes. Then these peasant people, where people lived in small villages, and in these small villages they told each other quite different things from what the Catholic priests preached. In these villages, within these domains in which there were the village communities, by means of external power, the Catholic religion spread itself. So we've described one stream which proceeded in the Latin language. What did these people know, those people who built their churches, those people who continue to propagate the wisdom in the Latin language, what do these people know about what was going on in the villages? People who, after the day's work, sat around in the evening and they told stories which consisted for the great part out of kinds of dreams, just as we've learned existed dreamy visions, which we learned existed in the ancient Egyptians. We find that from the period beginning with the 4th century AD right to the 8th, 9th, 10th centuries AD, through all these village communities, there was a world conception which had been disappeared a long time in the southern regions, at least which had disappeared out of the upper 10,000. Long time ago, that out of these undergrounds there had developed, lifted up, that which was a fine culture with the upper 10,000. Now in the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries, we see crystallizing out of the mere village communities, gradually the cities begin to crystallize. There begins a city culture, as if people were torn away out of external nature when they gathered together and concentrated in the cities. We find emerging the city cultures. We can follow it right from Brittany, right deep into the Russian kingdom, right to Novgorod, from above right down to Spain, Italy, all over this remarkable urge towards the city culture. And when we research about that which actually lived in this transition to the city culture, then for that person who is able to study history inwardly, he discovers a great similarity, a similarity in nature to that which occurred when, after the Trojan Wars, there developed the city-states in Greece. So we could say that that which occurred at that time in Greece, about 1200 BC, that now occurred in 950 AD. And so you add 1200 and 950 together, you get 2150, a whole epoch of development. You can say the Germanic people who migrated into into these areas were a whole epoch behind. These Germanic people who came over from the east, they were a whole epoch behind those people into whose domain they migrated. You can say these tribes who came to confront the southern population, the population of the southern lands, these tribes in their blood brought something to these people which actually in its basis was earlier possessed by these southern peoples. These Germanic tribes coming from the east brought the sentient soul culture into the intellectual soul culture which was there in southern Europe. Now you have the marriage, the world historical marriage between that which swam over there in the Latin language and that which was in the folk language. Remaining behind folk languages worked themselves up to the surface. And this, you had a marriage between that and the Latin language. And out of these two elements, there had to proceed that which could then develop itself further. And this led in the 15th century to the development of the so-called consciousness soul. The ancient culture would have completely disappeared if this new aspect did not insert itself and was received by the southern element, the south, through the fact that something which had remained, that into something that remained behind, something which had progressed forward entered itself, through that there was a balancing effect. And in the place of the pure intellectualistic culture, there entered the consciousness culture. The intellect became pure, a mere shadow. It was a shadow product, as something which lives only in inner activity. In this way, man, as it were, was freed from being inwardly possessed by the intellect. Now he could apply the intellect freely in inner activity, and he could pass over to an external observation of nature, as Galileo, Copernicus, and Kepler proceeded to an external nature investigation. But in order for that to happen, the intellect had to be freed. You see, all that which has arisen in European civilization since the beginning of the 15th century can be overall seen and regarded as that has to be led back into the penetration of this Germanic element into the ancient Latin Romanic element. When you study the single personalities, you can actually perceive this. Insofar as man developed himself from the south, he was entering, as it were, into a vacuum and emptiness. They experienced a very strong consciousness of the fact that with the development of their intellect, they are proceeding into something empty, into a vacuum. Certain personalities did not want to steer themselves into something new. Perhaps you can explain the situation like this. They would express it this way. Either we permit the intellect to be free, we permit it to develop itself, then the following would occur. Whereas earlier, out of the human being, there rose up that which had permeated him inwardly with the soul spiritual. Now he has arrived at a high point where his development would become free so that he could develop himself into the vacuum, into the emptiness. That which no longer attaches itself to his body, that must, when it is further developed, lead to the fact that that a spiritual world penetrates into man from the external. That was one thing which they people could have said to themselves. On the other hand, they could also say the following to themselves. We shall continue to preserve the ancient wisdom. We will conserve the ancient wisdom. And then we could say to human beings the following. So far as you have developed yourself into the 4th century with your intellect, you arrived at the end. You can't go any further. You have entered into the emptiness. Therefore, now look behind. Don't look in front. Don't stride forward into the further into the emptiness in order to find in your striding forward further a new spirituality. Don't try to find a new spirituality. Go backwards. And it's with this instinct, permeated with this instinct of trying to preserve the ancient, to hold the intellect at that point, not permitting it to develop further. This was something which permeated the 8th Ecumenical Council of Constantinople, 869 AD, which as a Catholic dogma dogmatized something which can be expressed in the following words: man has one soul, which is a thinking and spiritual at the same time, and more than this soul, man does not have anything spiritual further than this soul, because if a further spiritual were ascribed to man, then the path would be free, enabling him to develop a new spirituality. Because of that, the three membering of man as body, soul, and spirit, of that three membering, the spirit was taken away, and the soul was ascribed to itself merely single spiritual qualities. Man does not constitute body, soul, and spirit, but man is constituted by body and soul, and the soul has thinking and spiritual qualities. Other than that, one should not pursue. And that became a dogma. This was nothing other than the confirmation of that which actually was already given in the situation, with the preserving of the ancient, the intellectual working over of the ancient, but which at the same time should prevent the further progressing of mankind on the path of spiritual development. This way, they extinguish something which could be born out of the confluence of the flowing together of the streams. That is something which has continued to work beyond the 15th century right into our own age. On the one hand, man became instinctively mature, not just making a halt with the intellect, which he gradually became master of, intellect which could activate itself to an inner activity. Man was mature enough not to remain standing at this intellectual stage, but to continue to work on making this intellect inwardly active. Instead of that, man was made to stop at the shadow of the intellect, and a shadowy intellect you cannot develop. If man had been permitted to continue to develop this intellect activity, the intellect actively, man would have come in his own path towards a spirituality and would need the church. Because this shadow aspect, because the church held man at this shadow aspect of the intellect, as a result of that, the subsequent philosophizing was of a shadowy nature. And because of that, Kantianism arose, which ultimately plutches around in forms and categories in the shadow aspects. And the other philosophies which subsequently arose were actually a plutching around in a shadow world. So because you can't do very much by developing further this shadowy intellect, you, instead of developing further this shadowy intellect, you can fill it with something else. And what could you fill it with? You could fill it with the external world. That could be only the external nature. So what occurred did not occur out of the sort of reasons because man earlier on was in a child state, and now gradually he could develop to the knowledge of nature. The reason was that man, in his development, he needed something to fill it up. And in the last 4 to 5 centuries, we've experienced this filling up. This filling up of the shadowy intellect with what could be filled in from external nature. The shadowy intellect was able to take power, able to control the world of nature. And this was a high point. Precisely in the middle of the 19th century, the intellect had arrived at its most shadowy nature. If the intellect in itself is of a most spiritual nature, no longer took it into account. Of course, it had become a shadow. Instead of that, instead of developing the intellect internally, you had a well-developed, spread-out natural science. Intellect had filled itself out with what was offered to it by external nature from the outside. But more and more, there disappeared the possibility of being able to see the soul aspect. The soul aspect one could less and less see. Of course, one actually, when one turned towards the external world, they had only the shadow intellect. Hence, psychology, the soul teaching of the 19th century, became more and more, I might say, nominalistic. It became more and more word plunkerly, more skirmishing in words. A very dreary situation to read in the psychologies of the 19th century, how their people more and more speak about feeling, willing, thinking. And actually, all they are talking about are mere words. Until ultimately, Fritz Mautner comes along, and he makes the remarkable great discovery that all knowledge consists only in words. People have been continuously fooling themselves in being able to look for anything behind the words. This is characteristic for the 19th century. Actually, this discovery of Mautner, taken in the main, was not so far off the mark. The 19th century weaved itself, especially when it speaks of the soul aspect, it weaves itself only in words. So the people ultimately, this weaving in words, this continuous jungling about with thinking, feeling, willing, apperception and perception, and all possible words which have arisen in the English psychology since the time of Hume, particularly in the 19th century, since the time of John Stuart Hill. This juggling around with those words became so much of a jungling nature that people became dumb. Finally, people arrived at the remarkable discovery when they said to themselves, now we have in natural science, through our experimenting, have reached so many wonderful things. Therefore, let us now experiment more with the soul. Let's do experiments with the soul. And one made apparatus. One could give signals. When you when the man receives a perception, and then you can learn when he becomes conscious of this perception. A man, for example, moves his hand as a result of this perception. You could experiment with all these sort of things. Right into our time, the situation developed itself that one does not want to evaluate the capacity of children through an ability to transpose oneself into the child's gamut through a certain devoting to this child gamut, but instead of that, through apparatuses, you want to test memory, you want to test thinking, test all possible things. Arrive at the situation in the Russian schools, where no longer do you have tests in the ancient style, but with the help of an apparatus, an external apparatus, you can establish whether a child has certain capacities. Actually, to be sure, this Bolshevistic opinion has already penetrated into our districts, into our areas. Certain opponents of anthroposophy would like to establish in such an external way if our anthroposophy rests upon a truth. But that really is the result of the influence of the Bolshevistic approach. All this ultimately has to be traced as a result of that which has happened because of the non-consideration of the spiritual, of the spirit, able to apply the shadowy intellect upon the world of nature, and through that to produce a grandiose, magnificent natural science. Do this upon the one side. However, on the other side, to permit the soul aspect not to be considered properly. My dear friends, this soul aspect, that nevertheless wants to make it validate itself, and that does make itself validate itself by coming out of the depths of the human being. It insists on being researched. To understand the situation today, we have to go back centuries beforehand to be able to understand how the things that exist today are a result of what happened centuries ago. And even if modern science believes itself to be independent of the church, nevertheless, it stands under the influence of the church dictate, of the church dogma, that man consists only out of body and soul and has no spirit. Spirit which the church eliminated from our consideration, it is to this spirit that we must again arrive. Must again return to this spirit. And taken in the main, spiritual science can be designated as a striving to again arrive at the spirit, and with this spirit to be able to again investigate the soul aspect. And because of that, we can say the spirit must again be led into the conception of mankind, into the perception of mankind. Against this, there is a significant resistance, a frightful resistance, a frightful obstacle. It could be said that one is rather reluctant to speak about these hindrances, these resistances, because if you do that, you are treading on rather frightfully thin ice. At one time, it's necessary to be able to investigate the whole signature of the period, of the time. People must apply their attention to that which actually inserts itself as an impulse in our age. In this connection, you must keep in mind the following. Since the middle of the 15th century, since man there lives in a shadowy intellect and experiences actually his whole soul existence as something of a shadowy nature. Since this time, since the middle of the 15th century, man was completely directed, pointed towards the external nature. And so he gradually arrived at the fact of investigating the external phenomena of nature, not in the experimental way in which Goethe investigated external nature. Goethe, who at the same time was simultaneously ensouled by an ancient spirit, and gradually came to look for something behind the phenomenon, something which, taken in the main, was also supposed to be a kind of phenomenon. However, something which ought not to be permitted to have been transposed, inserted in that way. And man thus arrived at atomism. Man arrived at the fact of conceiving behind the sense world still another invisible sense world, small beings, small demonic beings, the atoms. Man conceived of the atoms. Instead of passing over into a spiritual world, he passed over to a duplicate of the sense world. He passed over again to a sense world. And in this way, he made rigid his capacity for cognition of the external sense world. And this, in the course of the 19th century, brought more and more something which had continuously gespukt, something which continuously had haunted the situation, something, however, which precisely as a result of this complete rigidification into the external world, stepped forward in the 19th century for the first time with a complete radicalismus. This something was the Ausspintisierung, the smoothing out of the law of the maintenance of energy, the conservation of energy, the conservation of force. It was said that in the cosmic all there never arise new forces, but the old forces transform themselves in such a way that the totality of forces remains constant. If we focus our attention upon a certain moment, as it were, if we cut it out of the cosmic happenings, then right up to this moment there existed a certain totality of energy. Now, in the next moment, these energies may have grouped themselves in a different way, that may have been subjected to different transformations. But all you have are different transformations. The total energy remains the same. Now, my dear friends, there were two things which could no longer be distinguished. Certainly, one had a complete justification to speak about the fact that measure, number, and weight, all these remain in the energies. However, one confuses that with the energies themselves. I'm going to repeat these two sentences because you have to meditate on them. I myself at this moment don't completely understand them. Rudolf Steiner does not amplify these two sentences, but I'll repeat them again for your benefit and for mine. These are the two sentences. One had a complete justification to speak about the fact that measure, number, and weight, these things remain in the energies. However, one confuses that with the energy itself. You work out what these two sentences mean. I don't at this moment, but you have much more time than I have. I have to proceed further. But I mention, Rudolf Steiner does not amplify what is meant here. It should have been amplified. Or perhaps I'm too dumb to understand it. Okay? Continue. Now, if this teaching of energies, this law of the constancy of energy, this law which dominates today the whole of natural science, if this law were correct, then there could not exist any freedom. Then any idea of freedom would be a mere and sheer illusion. Because of that, for those people who were followers and believers in this law of the constancy of energy, for them, freedom always was an illusion. Just visualize for yourself how such people, like, for example, Wundt, who tried to explain this very freedom which man himself feels that he is free. For example, you have the donkey between two bundles of hay, which are equally large and equally smelling enough, this is equally tasty, one to the left and one to the right. So if I were free, then I would be attracted equally to one side as to the other, and I would not be able to make a decision, and I would die of hunger. If I have not to distinguish between two such things, but if I am called upon to distinguish between, or to decide between many things, so nevertheless, according to such psychologists, I am driven. Of course, there exist there so many concepts which interweave, which shove into each other, concepts which take hold of me and work into each other. And after so, ultimately, I make my decision. And I believe that I'm actually acting out of a feeling of freedom. Whereas in point of fact, it's merely these different concepts that are pushing me. This is the sort of thing that you find in numerous academic learned works as to represent a very great achievement of modern thinking, an achievement that is born out of natural science. You have to see that freedom is actually impossible if the law of the conservation of force were really there. Because if actually, at any given moment, I would be determined by all that exists before that moment, then all I'm dealing with is transformation of energies. And then freedom would be a pure illusion. Thus, as a result of the development of mankind in the 19th century, by the establishment of the law of the constancy of energy, it implies that we have a natural scientific conception which excludes freedom as an idea, which makes it impossible. Of course, human beings unconditionally are made to be a product of the necessity of the ordering of nature. This was something which was prepared gradually since centuries. How should it then be with things like ethical responsibility, morals, ethic, religious conviction? These sort of things could not actually exist if all you had was only the ordering of nature. The materialists of the 19th century, in a certain way, they were absolutely honest insofar as they had to deny these ethical illusions of previous periods and have explained man really to be only a product of a natural necessity. Those people who were beneficiaries of institutions which depend upon freedom, ethics, and religion, these people did not have the courage which David Friedrich Strauss had, or other people. These other materialists had greater courage than these other people. I presume he means religious institutions who have to believe what they believe. That they're not as honest as the materialists. Those who follow the proving of science and follow the origin of the universe insofar as the world is supposed to have had its origin out of a primal mist and continuously of necessity develops they following conditions that all the forces remain constant. With this sort of science, you can't deal at all with ethics or religion. And because of that, these beneficiaries of these institutions say, away with this science. Let's put this science aside and let's just have faith. And so you have what might be called a double bookkeeping. One side you keep your books for the external world, for the world of nature, for science. The other set of books you have on faith. And out of these other set of books, you prove the existence of God and you establish an ethics. So we say for ourselves an entirely different domain from the domain of science. We live in two different domains, double bookkeeping. You see, ever since the development of the modern world, you have those people who want to save faith. When science enters into the situation, things become very difficult for them. Now, as we've mentioned, we're dealing here with the law of the conservation of energy. But this law is something which is a dogmatic law. It's become a natural scientific dogmatic prejudgment, prejudice. Because what actually does this law of the conservation of mass and energy, what does it actually signify? You can make the following experiment. You can place yourself before a bank building and observe how much money is carried into the bank. And out of that, I form for myself a statistic. And then I observe how much money is carried out of the bank. And also, I also make about that another statistic. And I see that the same amount of money is carried out as that which is carried in. Now I have to swing myself up to the idea that there in the bank there are people who are working. And what comes out is indeed only the transformed money. There you have the law of the constancy of the magnitude of the amount of money. People made very beautiful experiments. You calculate the warmth energy of the food you eat, and then you calculate that which these people perform as acts. You get an equivalency of that which has been taken in as food and the work that's been expended. So here you have the law of the conservation of force. On nothing other does this law of the conservation of force rest upon than upon such a totality of such prejudices or prejudgments. A comment here, I'm afraid Rudolf Steiner has not convinced me by his argument here so far that the law of conservation of energy of natural science is invalid. He's tried to, but he's failed as far as I'm concerned. Maybe, as I say, I'm too dumb to understand him. I'm not saying I agree with the law of conservation of energy, but all I'm saying is the sort of things he's presented so far, to my understanding, are not convincing me that they have made a mistake. Continue with Rothstein, and he says, and if one does not lift oneself above this law of the conservation of force, so with this law of the conservation of force, you will extinguish the spiritual. Since this law of the conservation of force is a result of the slipping in, of the inserting itself, of the intellect in external nature, and the looking away from the soul aspect. And as far as the soul aspect is concerned, we can further penetrate into it if we again penetrate into the spiritual. And to penetrate into this spiritual, this means nothing other than to really understand what there actually entered into world evolution at the beginning of the Christian era as a completely new impulse, as the Christ impulse. I've already mentioned to you that this Christ impulse has been understood by this spiritual stream or by this other spiritual stream. However, today we are placed into the necessity of being able to understand this Christ impulse in a new way. People didn't understand that this intellect, which was proceeding into a vacuum, that out of this vacuum, so to speak, a new spiritual ought to arrive. One had taken the Christ. I told you that already. The Neoplatonism took it into the human inner being. That, up to now, has become the custom. They have considered the Christ being only in connection with the inner of the human being. However, we must, insofar as we penetrate, push forward to the external world, we must also consider the Christ as united with the external world, which means we must know the Christ as being active in the evolution of the external world. This is precisely the thing with which one battles anthroposophy. And one criticizes anthroposophy because anthroposophy doesn't talk about the Christ in empty phrases. But actually, in anthroposophy, one sees the Christ again in connection with the whole world evolution. When we speak about the fact that it really is a cosmic event, that there actually a cosmic being appeared within a human body. Just as every day the light of the sun unites itself with the earth, so something cosmic penetrates the earth upon the earthly domain, so such things occurred in the spiritual domain. But these sort of things the intellectuals of our present time cannot understand. That is necessary, that which in the first place has been won upon the domain of natural science with that intellect which has become a shadow. Because this intellect has become a shadow, it is capable of being applied as a free human capacity upon the external world. And that this intellect can also be applied to the inner world, and hence the rising up to imagination, to inspiration, and hence the rising up to a real spiritual knowledge. It was a matter of historical development of mankind that out of that you had the necessity of natural science. Natural science was a necessity in the historical development of mankind. And out of the presence and existence of natural science, that also provides the necessity to rise up into the science of the spirit. Turn to the science of the spiritual, the science of the spirit in the anthroposophical sense, that is not a fad. That itself is an historical fact of development, just as natural science was an historical fact of development. As I told you, when you talk about this, you're already treading on thin ice, and we have to point to our focus, our attention on there where the resistances are, where the hindrances, where the obstacles are. Obstacles on the one side exist in something like the law of the conservation of energy, force. There were two laws in the 19th century which in a twofold way wanted to limit the human intellect to focus itself purely upon that which lives in the material aspect, in the earth sense aspect. One law was given by the council, the natural scientific councils, the dogma of the natural scientific councils as the law of the conservation of energy. If the law of the conservation of energy is correct, human knowledge could not advance to the recognition of the spiritual and to the recognition of freedom. But it must remain in a pure, or to remain standing at a pure automatic necessity. You remain standing with a soul element which has gradually become a shadow. Then you can't transcend, go beyond that which was established as a dogma in the Ecumenical Council of Constantinople, 1869. There you have the council which proceeded from the natural scientific science, and that other council which represents its polaric contrast, that other council which established in 1870 the infallibility of the papal office when he speaks ex cathedra. With that, in order to arrive at knowledge, you do not appeal to anything spiritual, but you have to appeal to the Roman Pope. That Pope who ex cathedra makes the decision as to which Catholic teaching is true and which teaching shall be dogmatized as false. Air was fetched down out of the spiritual heights upon the earth into the material, and there upon the earth there shall be the decision made about truth and error. Just as in the material aspect, our knowledge is dominated by the law of the constancy of force. So, immersing itself in the materiality, you have the living development of man in the spiritual through the dogma of infallibility. Both belong together. Dogma of the conservation of energy and the dogma of papal infallibility. Both relate themselves as North and South Poles. However, what we need in mankind's development is a free spirituality. That which should dominate us must be not the natural scientific dogma, not the papal dogma, but what should dominate us should be the spiritual itself. And man must find his own path into the spiritual. And for that reason, we need to ascend into the spiritual. We need this ascent in order to lift ourselves up from that defeat which the spirit has suffered, insofar as the law of the conservation of force was established, and that other defeat which the spirit has experienced, insofar as everything of religious nature has become materialized. So far as it was brought down to earth by Rome, who was to make the decision about what is true and what is false. In order to make this ascent into the spiritual, to follow the path of the spiritual, that's not easy, because the world is permeated by complete superficiality. And hence it is already very difficult in that which upon the one side yields itself as a out of world historical development as a factual impulse, and what upon the other side yields itself out of the way of thinking of natural science, which has dogmatized itself with the law of the conservation of energy or force. Very difficult. However, it's necessary, in spite of this difficulty, to work your way really to a knowledge of the spiritual world. Much will rise up against this work which we're trying to do in the cognitive grasping of the spiritual world. But this work must continue. And even if for a time being the opponents have the power, nevertheless, we must study from history and be able to learn out of the study of history itself how we should fire up our will and warm our hearts. If we study history in this way and permit history to work upon us, then history will show us that our deeds must reach their fulfillment, that that which must penetrate into the spiritual, into the life of rights in the state, into the economic life, that the spiritual element has to penetrate all these. This is something which, to conclusion, I had to say. I wanted in the first place to provide you with an objective presentation how natural science grows out of the course of development of mankind and the knowledge that it is a teaching of real history, not an agnostic history which we have lived through in the 19th century, but it is a teaching of real history. We human beings, we have to work forward to spiritual knowledge. And he ends the lecture.